wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Every Monday morning, the Moles offer our listeners a variety of views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonialist perspective. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. Despite the COVID-related shutdown, KBOO is still on the air. Unlike many community radio stations, we have managed to keep broadcasting during these difficult and exciting times. To keep our work going, you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station anymore to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Once again, that's kboo.fm/give. You can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Now, more than ever, it's important to support independent media. Today on our show, I'm going to be interviewing Jan Hocken about her just-published book called Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD, which charts the social history of the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. Lori Mercier will be talking with Robin White and Desiree Hellegers about their new digital archive for the fight against climate change and fossil fuels in the Pacific Northwest. First on the show today, we have Bill Resnick speaking with Whitney Maxey, a community organizer with Memphis for All. They discuss her personal journey through basketball and engineering to community organizing, why a Black socialist would vote for Joe Biden, and a pathway to a radically democratic and sustainable world.
Hi, Whitney Maxey. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Whitney Maxey is a community organizer in Memphis, Tennessee, with the grassroots political organization Memphis for All, that's building power of a multiracial cross-class alliance in Memphis. She's also worked all over Florida, including the Miami Workers Center, and she travels all over the South working with and conferring with groups like Durham for All in North Carolina. Whitney Maxey grew up in Tallahassee, Florida, got a basketball scholarship to Chipotle College, graduated, and worked as an engineer for 3 years. A little over 10 years ago, she changed careers, began community organizing and writing and speaking, joined the editorial collective of the webzine called Organizing Upgrade, that was in early 2020, and came to serve on the staff of Liberation Road on their National Executive Committee. I've read several of her articles on how the left must vote for Biden and defeat Trump in the far right, also strengthen the socialist wing of the anti-Trump front, also shift the national balance of forces, thicken our relationships to visionary organizations rooted in working class communities and color, I'm quoting Whitney, also engage new politicized activists, and finally come out of the 2020 election with greater cohesion and a stronger position. Whitney, first, tell us about your own personal journey from basketballer and engineer to community organizer fighting for justice and the poor.
Thank you so much, Bill. So my personal journey, like so many journeys of other people, starts before I was even thought of. So I just come from a lineage of strong Black Southern women who didn't just accept what society was trying to tell them, how they should be, who they should be. And so much of their lives were emblematic of rejecting certain norms and really kind of embracing their own ideas of femininity and what it means to have justice and what community looks like. I very much come from that, and spirit is there. And so if we kind of fast forward into my life, starting out as a basketball player, you quickly learn how much you love something when you have to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do it. And so I did not love basketball is what I'm getting at, Bill. I actually only played 1 year and wound up just focusing my education on getting an engineering degree and eventually going into the engineering field, where I just always felt there was a higher calling for me, quite frankly. You know, I didn't have an articulation from it. Growing up, I wasn't involved with or wasn't aware of, you know, any kinds of explicit organizing or left politics outside of the two sentences in European history class where they talk about Karl Marx and say he was a bad, crazy man. So the global financial crisis, honestly, after being laid off as an engineer, just kind of sent me searching for what the thing was that I was feeling called to. And I mean, it's so serendipitous that I wound up at the Miami Worker Center. And so I just through working with people on a campaign with SEIU at the time called Fight for a Fair Economy, who were just these really amazing, thoughtful, revolutionary folks who, you know, had been in movements for decades, some of them. So it was really at that point where I started to kind of sharpen my ideology and my worldview and started to learn what it meant and what it takes to organize our folks and the people that we care about.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Hour on Able Radio 90.7 FM Portland. I'm talking to Whitney Maxey, a community organizer, writer in Memphis, Tennessee, and also an activist with Liberation Road. And we've been talking about her journey to socialism. So, Whitney, why did you suggest in one of your articles, as a socialist, why did you suggest we vote for Biden, but then force his administration into supporting a set of reform measures that, for one, are necessary to stop climate change and save the human experiment, and also make life much better for the poor people of Memphis and the world, and also demonstrate how we could win a much more just and democratic world. Tell us about why we vote for Biden, but then we fight him and force the Biden administration to enact measures that would really be important and show the way to a better future.
Before I kind of talk about this moment that we find ourselves in right now leading up to this 2020 election, I want to take a step back and talk about a kind of broader context of a strategic fight. I think the understanding for me of the right, who some of us refer to as the new Confederacy, that's made up of these reactionary sectors of capital that, you know, include big oil, for an example, but are also made up these kind of really reactionary racist sectors of our country. And that is largely driven by white, downwardly mobile, disillusioned middle strata folks who have felt the brunt of neoliberalism, and the right in a broad sense has provided them a kind of ideological home and a home for their whatever kinds of agenda that different sectors of their base are trying to move and fight for. And, you know, there are plenty of fissures, contradictions within the right. For me, you know, that's our kind of most immediate strategic enemy, and Trump and Trumpism are the kind of most dangerous neo-fascist, if you will, block within the right who, you know, this moment is forcing lots of people to have to confront. And recognizing that, you know, there's this broader strategic fight at hand for me and many of the people that I organize with, this is more about a tactical moment of us saying, if we sit out, if we as the left sit out, or if we play a demobilizing force in any way, then essentially what we're doing is abandoning some of our folks, right? We're abandoning plenty of Black, Brown, AAPI folks who are feeling the brunt of this pandemic, who are at the intersections of the multifold crisis of the economy, deterioration of our planet, as well as the global impacts and kind of dynamics between the likes of U.S. And China, who are, you know, in this kind of global hegemonic fight, while we're watching the political legitimacy of the U.S. both internally degrade as well as watching it degrade further on a national stage. This is all that characterizes and fits into this moment. And so part of us being in this fight is just showing up for our folks. Second, the tactical decision to vote for Biden in this election is about trying to create the most favorable conditions possible for our movement to be able to continue the kind of fights that we've been engaging in around national demands, such as Medicare for All and some version of Green New Deal legislation and the BREATHE Act that was introduced by Movement for Black Lives, those types of things. So continuing to try to both build a national left progressive platform as well as putting the pieces in place to try to fight for that platform. So when the term dump Trump, fight enforce Biden, within that it's the recognition that Trump and Trumpism, like those who are ideologically aligned with him, pose the biggest threat to our folks in this moment, and that a vote for Biden is not where we stop. It is just the beginning, and that beginning is about us growing our organizational and movement infrastructure from the national to the local level that coheres an array of anti-Trump, pro-democracy forces, as well as using that infrastructure to apply sustained mass pressure on Biden around, again, the social democratic, if you will, demands that have come to represent the interests of the left progressive movements.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Whitney Maxey, a community organizer and writer in Memphis, Tennessee, and activist with Liberation Road Socialist Organization. We've been talking about first our journey to socialism. Next, the kind of reforms we might win from a Biden administration. Whitney, you discussed how you have to show up for the people we represent in the cities that we're fighting for and that we're contributing to their own self-organization. Let's talk about the programs that you could force the Biden administration into. That, of course, assumes that the Biden administration would listen to the left, and I think they would because the left is powerful in the party, especially at the grassroots, at the rank and file. And it also has a lot of representation of people like Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez in the Congress, and they have lots of support from others. Biden administration has to deal with us. And there are signs of that, actually, in their climate action plan, which I went through, which talked about some fairly radical policies. What issues would you bring into your local organizing? You mentioned health care for all, a single-payer system. How would you organize for them in a way such that people also see the possibilities of real democracy, of working-class people actually asserting their power and exercising it in ways that actually make this a society very, very different in terms of the way people interact far more democratically with everybody making part of the decisions that shape their own lives? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think the first thing I want to say is I completely agree that Biden has shown that he's susceptible to pressure from not only left and progressive movements, but also the burgeoning left progressive governing bloc that you just referenced with the AOCs or the Squad. I would even include Elizabeth Warren within that unity task force that they came up with to kind of name what the platform would be for essentially the corporate Dems who are currently in control of the party. Our ability to do that, and even Biden to feel the need to even bring those folks to the table, is a shift, right? That's a notable shift in terms of our relative influence in like the needs have to respond to us. Now, Biden is also susceptible to the right, so I don't want to paint a one-sided picture. He is a site of struggle for certain ideas and views. But in terms of the kind of national demands that could be localized, I feel less clear, honestly, about Medicare for All and what that could maybe look like in the context of Memphis and the state of Tennessee than I've just thought a little more about Green New Deal legislation, which I think, you know, on the national level, there's certainly some work for the left and progressive movements to do to have a unifying Green New Deal framework and narrative, because currently there are different versions of the original resolution that was presented by AOC and some others. So, yeah, I think there's a need to truly have something that everybody can get aligned around. But when I think about what Green New Deal-inspired legislation could look like in the state of Tennessee, and perhaps Memphis in particular, in Tennessee, there's the largest publicly owned, as in government-run, energy company called Tennessee Valley Authority. And currently, the spike that's been shaping up where the private sector under neoliberalism has tried to chip away at TVA's programs and its ability to sustain itself. And that's not to say that TVA was some perfect entity even when it was created, but it is to say it was one of the better things that we had out there in terms of trying to address issue of energy access and energy democracy. And so one of the more recent fights that have started to take place are some of the local energy companies in different cities across Tennessee are thinking about leaving TVA and potentially going into the private market to get energy, which takes away some of the accountability, takes away some of the potential for people to have more say over what's happening with their access to power, power in terms of energy power, but also political power. For me, that's one of the fights that when I look at different places around the South and trying to think how could this national general framework of a Green New Deal, regardless of a version you're talking about, you know, what are some ways to try to think about it locally that impact who has jobs and what kind of jobs, which obviously the race through which we want to be looking at and fighting for jobs. And then there's the question about who's able to make decisions about TVA and the kinds of services it offers. And, you know, in a place like Tennessee, where you have the largest amount of the Black population is in the western part of the state, there's a real question about what energy democracy look like for us in relationship to the rest of Tennessee. And then also all of the rural communities here that are also constantly fighting for access to energy, but also other services that are largely being stripped away from them over time as, you know, we become a more and more urbanized society. So that's an example of the kind of, I think, national legislation that could be localized and connected to a much bigger thing for people here on the ground.
How do we build that one great movement that the Wobblies so heroically fought for in the early part of the century? Give us your thoughts.
Yeah, so I think for the left, this is the perennial question, particularly in the United States. And so I don't have the answer for it, but there are certainly some things that I've learned and observed along the way about some of the things that we would need. So one would be a kind of united front that's much broader than anything that currently exists, and that includes different parts of society that are engaged in some form of movement against austerity and or against white supremacy and or against any kind of cis-hetero patriarchy. And then our movement would need to be non-sectarian, and non-sectarian in the sense of it being able to hold conflicting and sometimes contradictory views and dynamics, but the kind of glue for the movement would be brought into a unified goal and vision that allows us to name what is necessary for us to have alignment on, and therefore the things that we should prioritize, versus the things where it's important for us to have alignment on, but it doesn't make or break our ability to actually achieve our goals and vision. And then perhaps the last thing is that, you know, it has to have a decades-long strategy with a clearly defined and agreed upon enemy in which we need to defeat, which again, I and folks that I organize with in this moment largely think of the new Confederacy as that enemy that we should have this multi-decade strategy around. And then the last thing is obviously national movement infrastructure that can hold these broader array of forces that would need to make up this united front against the new Confederacy.
Whitney Maxey, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you so much, Bill, for the invitation.
Keep up the good work.
Those are certainly words for our time. That was a clip of the song People Have the Power, written by Patti Smith and Fred Sonic Smith, and sung here by Patti Smith. I want to remind everyone out there who's listening that your community radio station, KBOO, is on the air because of the generous support of listeners like you. If this is important to you, and if you can, please help sustain the station by going to kboo.fm/give. You can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Please help keep us on the air. Next up on The Old Mole, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Jan Hocken about her latest book called Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD, which was just published. Jan, in addition to being a mole herself, is also a documentary filmmaker, a writer, and professor emeritus of psychology at Portland State University. Now, you could call her latest book a biography of a diagnosis in this case, that would be post-traumatic stress disorder. But I thought it was really much broader than that. It's like a meditation on how we understand and deal with human suffering, particularly in the context of late-stage capitalism. So, Jan, I would like to start with your telling us about what inspired you to write this book.
Well, I like your term, a biography of a diagnosis, and would add it's also an autobiography of a diagnosis. I've been a practicing clinician, and as a feminist, early on, influenced by the women coming into the field and challenging and rejecting a lot of the old diagnoses, like hysteria, as a classic example, and in many ways, refusing much of the whole project of psychiatry. And I was also influenced by radical psychiatry that really took on the medical model. And during that era, there was a lot of interest in people with disturbances that were associated with psychoses or schizophrenia, and listening to madness, as the term was, encompass many people with serious disorders, and the idea that people who were mad also had a lot to say about the world around them. So there was a interest in that era in not just diagnosing people, but understanding what diagnoses and the mental disturbances express about the broader society. There were a lot of tendencies to over-romanticize the mentally ill during that era, but it all came to a halt during the 70s and 80s as mental health services were cut back. People were only listening to the psychotic long enough to get them on meds. So I was interested in, after this period, there was a shift in which diagnoses invited interest in the mental health field. And they were almost without exception trauma diagnoses and extreme stress reactions. So I became interested and published quite a bit along the way on why trauma stories in the last decades of the 20th century dominated the mental health field versus chronic conditions that had been described and of interest to clinicians during earlier eras. And part of what was central to a trauma diagnosis was that it required a dramatic story of a discrete event of some kind that would explain your symptoms and your impairments.
Well, one of the other concepts that I think came out of this diagnosis that you talk a lot about in the book was the idea that mental health disorders were not necessarily somehow part of the individual that was fundamentally impaired, but also could involve normal people breaking down in the face of significantly abnormal or traumatic events. Tell us a little bit more about what the significance of that idea was.
Yeah, the phrase associated most with PTSD is that it's a normal response to an abnormal situation, and that was codified early on and has changed some. But the basic idea is still there, that people who are quite normal in the psychiatric sense can look extremely disturbed and have symptoms associated with serious disorders under certain conditions of exposure to extreme stress or conditions thought to be traumatic. And in the context of the social movements of the 70s, anti-war movement, the women's movement, that idea really resonated with on several fronts. First of all, feminists had for a very long time struggled with this idea that only women who have a problematic past or are mentally ill or either beaten, allow themselves to be beaten or allow themselves to be raped. So this movement to say, no, pre-existing conditions don't matter. It's irrelevant to your reactions to a rape or an assault. So this idea that normal people could develop extreme reactions was very important to the women's movement and also the anti-war movement. Up through the Vietnam War, it was assumed in the mental health field that most returning service members who had reactions to warfare, and there are different terms over the century for this. Many people are familiar with the concept of shell shock, different terms for extreme reactions in warfare. And it was assumed that most normal men, as was usually the case, returned to baseline functioning usually a few months after they returned from service. So the anti-war movement argued, no, there's nothing wrong with these fundamentally about these soldiers who continue to have extreme grief reactions, have had interpersonal problems, who have gotten into fights or drink heavily. They're carrying the suffering of warfare, the burdens of warfare that the society wants to put behind. They are continuing to bear the cost of war and these symptoms. And that was a very profound revolutionary shift in thinking in the mental health field, that normal people conditioned to continue to show symptoms. And it was a way of, I think, on another level, challenging cultural amnesia about social problems, which is itself an American syndrome, putting it behind you very quickly. People should move on, get over it.
And in the context of a military situation, that is even more apparent. And much of your writing comes out of your experiences embedding with
Combat stress control unit.
Yeah, in Afghanistan, and the conflicts there that the psychologists had to face and how they dealt with soldiers who were having emotional, psychological reactions. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I really started tuning in, as we say clinicians, with my third ear to what's going on culturally and in the mental health field with this diagnosis when I was carrying out this documentary project. It's called Mind Zone, behind therapists behind the front lines, following a unit as they trained and deployed to Afghanistan. And throughout that project, I was interested in mental health problems in the military and the military's own shift toward destigmatizing mental health reactions and a kind of warmer, more maternal military, especially the Army, but all the branches focused on destigmatizing mental health reactions. And it seemed that every time this project was discussed or I was interviewed about it, it was described as a project about PTSD, the military. And I would say, well, it's really about mental health reactions and how they're managed in the military. I thought, this is very interesting. Whatever it is, it's PTSD. Soldiers are committing suicide at higher rates. Well, it's PTSD, untreated PTSD. And I thought, there's a kind of defensive function that's kind of gathered up around this diagnosis, where it's a way of both talking about something and not talking about it, acknowledging and containing it. And so then I undertook this study of, based on my analysis of interviews, of how clinicians themselves were using the diagnosis under conditions where they felt pressure to respond and in a way that was sympathetic with service members, but also kind of managed them in some way.
As you describe it in your book, there was a line that they needed to draw between people who were truly distressed and those people who maybe were faking it in order to get out of military service or to get out of battle. That was one line that clinicians would have to draw. And there was also a line that had to be drawn between, as you describe it, the mad or the bad, people who were truly distressed versus those who were somehow fundamentally impaired, like with personality disorders. How did that line drawing play out in the context of these military stress units in Afghanistan?
That was also an area of psychiatry and diagnoses. And I use the term psychiatry because psychiatry produces the diagnostic and statistical manual and reaps revenues from the sale of that manual, and also has a leading role in the official recognition of diagnoses and their criteria. So, but I'm really talking about the whole mental health field and the way in which the mental health field and clinicians who work in mental health are arbiters in many institutional settings: the courts, prisons, hospitals, VA system, disability settings, are often in this situation where they're the judges, gatekeepers, arbiters of who is or isn't deserving of services and support. And in this country, and particularly during the rise of neoliberalism and the sometime around late 70s, 80s, with the rise of Reaganism, the push to marketize and privatize everything, the dismantling of social services, social welfare, and even ideas of around the need for support, the pathologizing of dependency, all of these factors influenced who could get services and who couldn't. And PTSD entered into that era in a very critical way as clinicians sense that this was a diagnosis. It's very flexible, like many psychiatric diagnoses, you know, that like, for example, the state psychiatric hospital where I did a documentary and carried out interviews, most of the patients there had had maybe a dozen diagnoses over their psychiatric history. So they often change depending on the, like drugs, you know, they're marketed diagnoses and have certain shelf life and currency to them. But PTSD emerged as a category that was the first in the manual that acknowledged a societal cause for which society carried responsibility. And the early prototypes were war and sexual assault.
So the diagnosis actually enabled people to make a claim on society for their suffering.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes gets missed when people frame trauma diagnoses as states of helplessness or people cast as helpless victims. It's actually quite the opposite, that people often they're asserting a claim and a grievance for which others are responsible and for which they are not implicated. And so that's how it's been so important in the courts. So if you're suing, if you're in a litigation around a traffic accident, you try to establish that you had no responsibility for it and you had no pre-existing conditions that contributed to your impairment. Well, PTSD was that kind of a forensic diagnosis. You can say, I was fine, perfectly fine, before this war and this particular incident in war or this particular sexual assault, I was fine. And the diagnosis is a way of also attaching a social responsibility to address it.
Yeah, one of the main themes you take up in the book is whether and how not PTSD is a progressive diagnosis. And unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have time to discuss that, but I want to say that the book is extremely rich and rewarding discussion of how it's really about human suffering and the various ways that society tries to manage that and how it has changed over time. Jan, one last word before we close our interview.
Yeah, it was very important for me to convey respect and even a better way of listening to suffering that PTSD does have currency and it grants people benefits and it's important to honor those benefits. But paradoxically, it's become a constraint that's interfered with listening and interfered with addressing more broadly problems of physical and emotional suffering. So that was important for me to recognize the two-sidedness of it. And I hope people find something useful about the book.
Thank you, Jan, for joining me today and talking about your new book called Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD.
Thanks so much, Patricia, for having me.
To wrap up our show today, Laurie Mercier interviews Robin White and Desiree Hellegers about their new digital archive to document anti-fossil fuel activism in the Pacific Northwest. The archive project is entitled The Green Line is People, Documenting Pacific Northwest Fossil Fuel Resistance.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking with Desiree Hellegers and Robin White, longtime activists and co-creators of the new online resource, The Thin Green Line is People History Project, documenting Pacific Northwest fossil fuel resistance. Welcome, Desiree and Robin. Nice to have you on the other end of the microphone for change.
Thanks for having me.
Desiree and Robin are frequent contributors to the Old Mole Variety Hour and are a community-based research team with the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice at Washington State University, Vancouver, where Desiree teaches and Robin serves on the university's Native American Community Advisory Board. So let's start. Tell us about the background and what prompted this project, the Thin Green Line as People.
I think it was really, first off, attending a lot of hearings related to the fossil fuel struggle. So Robin and I were both involved in different ways. And I think, you know, I want to say Robin way more consistently than I. Just hearing the courage and the passion of ordinary people stepping up and consistently at hearing after hearing to really struggle to protect the Pacific Northwest from having these, you know, being transformed into a toxic fossil fuel transit corridor. And I think particularly when Bill McKibben came through in 2013 and basically spoke about the Pacific Northwest emerging, and I think Vancouver specifically, emerging as a great choke point in the struggle for the survival of the planet as we know it. That seemed a really clear indication that WSU Vancouver in particular really needed to step up and have some role actively institutionally in documenting the struggle and helping to raise public awareness about the stakes in the struggle. So we really didn't want to see these voices and these documents disappearing. And one of the things that we were hearing is that eventually the documents might be much more difficult to get access to, that they might be buried by the fossil fuel companies, and we're finding out that that's actually fairly accurate in that, you know, some of the documents that were readily available online, now you have to wait, you have to file a public documents request, and it takes much longer to get them. But I think one of the other real inspirations for the project was the Seattle Civil Rights and Labor History Project out of the University of Washington, which kind of provided a really good model of how to collect a variety of resources to document a struggle. And in this case, the struggle is, very much living and ongoing, and we're trying to, load documents just as the struggle is kind of unfolding. And I just want to mention the participation of a couple other people in the project, including Daria Ruggles, Wade Ferguson, Antonio Zamora, who shot some of the video, and Barbara Ford, who's been really helpful in keeping the project moving. So I'm just going to punt to Robin.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of incredible things on here. This touches on so many parts of our lives. It really does with economy and social structure and climate collapse and health and whatever you can think of, it really does. And I think one of the important things to remember here, though, is that water is the most important thing here. I think that's the common denominator in anything. And, we really feel that if you're doing the right thing for water, then you're doing the right thing for everything else in the world. So, a lot of these people are water protectors. I think that's kind of an important thing to remember. There's some great things on here. You can get to what all the different actual what the stakes are in the fossil fuel struggle. So, kind of gives you an overview of everything that you can think of that we're, that's on the line for what's going on in the Northwest and in the world.
What's the significance of the title of the project, The Thin Green Line as People?
Thin Green Line was, I think, coined by Sightline, yes. Institute, correct. And then, we were kind of thinking there's the old movie of Soylent Green, which was a classic cult film. If you haven't seen it, 1973, Soylent Green. It's about the corporatocracy taking over society, and it ends, I'll kill the movie probably, but it's worth watching, that the Soylent Green is people. They were using all the people to make food to feed the people. So I think it was kind of a real lead-in to what's happening today, and I think the importance of that is. So we kind of thought that the Thin Green Line as People said a lot about what it actually is that we're doing and that everything about humanity is going into this.
Yeah, the attempt to kind of stave off this really dystopian future that we just got a quite an interesting glimpse into with the wildfires. And, you know, I just want to speak to another absolutely major element and driving dimension of the project, and that's to figure out how to really fast-track the fossil fuel struggle into principally universities, but also high schools as well. So universities, community colleges, and high schools. How do we take this kind of wealth of materials that's emerging from the struggle and really broaden the struggle by ensuring that it's being taught throughout the region? So another real inspiration for the project was Rethinking Schools and the Zen Education Project and the work that they're doing on climate justice in Portland public schools and across the country, and thinking about, you know, how do you kind of make use of these documents and how do you bring them into the university classroom as well. So we're really interested in working with people around the region who look at the site and think about ways that they might integrate some of these documents into their own teaching. And there's videotapes, there's oral histories, you know, there's kind of a wealth of multimedia elements in the project. So we definitely want to hear from teachers and professors who want to figure out how to integrate this into their work.
And you've got video clips from hearings, resolutions, ordinances, legislation, just really a wealth of documentation that should help both educators and activists in really continuing to mount this necessary struggle.
There's a section that's particularly devoted also to divestment campaigns. So I just want to do a little shout out for that, because I think one of our best hopes for the future of, you know, that doesn't look like Soylent Green, that doesn't look like what we just saw with the wildfires, is for universities, community colleges, churches, faith communities across the region to be stepping up and really struggling to mount effective divestment campaigns. And Robin has been, sort of constantly reminding me of the importance to focus also on reinvestment. So, you know, we have some documents around that, and we definitely welcome contributions for documents that we might have omitted.
So you're collecting information. People can continue to contribute to the project by contacting you, and you have contact information on the website.
That's correct.
This is a living, yes, breathing thing that's going to continue. So we really want to have that involvement with everybody that's doing this. You know, it's an important aspect of that, and so we need people to help us build it and keep it moving.
Desiree, I'm speaking with Desiree Hilligers and Robin White, the co-creators of a new online resource, The Thin Green Line is People, documenting Pacific Northwest fossil fuel resistance. And we've been talking about the wealth of resources available for activists, for educators, and the ways people might continue to contribute to the site. Robin, earlier we were talking about just some of the important documents and oral histories that are particularly powerful on the site that amplify the diverse voices defending the ecosystems and communities of the Pacific Northwest. Do you want to say something about some of the people featured here?
Well, yeah, you know, I think this is really important. I mean, sure, we all know some very, very famous people that have been involved in this struggle, and I think it's, you know, their work is extraordinary and so important. But the Thin Green Line is People is about people and how important it is that these people, you'll see a lot of these, I tried to concentrate on people that weren't those famous people. People that finally just had enough and they realized what was going on and they stood up and they said, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. We're going to do the right thing, no matter what the consequences of that were. And a lot of times to great economic disadvantage or political or social disadvantage or even physical danger. And I think that is what we're trying to say here, is that we can do this, that it's important to do this, that there is other people there behind you, that you don't, all you have to do is have the passion and the moral value to stand up to what's going on.
Well, Robin, you are one of the people featured in the activist oral history interviews. And then there are a variety of environmental activists and Native activists, as well as Kater Claybaugh, who's president of the ILWU Local 4 in Vancouver. Anything else you want to say about these oral histories?
Yeah, here you've got union leaders that, and like he says, I think one of his quotes was, you know, who would have thunk it? Kind of a blue collar union worker signing up with a tree hugging hippie environmentalist. But we are there. Danita Fry, who sadly has passed, was born and raised in Alaska, and her family, you know, lived off of the oil boom up there. And her mother was, she said something about her mother was saying, oh, those crazy people down there doing that kayaktivism and stopping that stuff coming up to Alaska on the bridge. And she says, Mom, I'm one of those people. Lana Jack, who's one of the last of her, last women of her people, expressing the tragedy of hundreds of years of this abuse and where it's getting us and what it means to really protect the water and to protect humanity. There's Jody McCaffrey, she's been fighting a project down in Coos Bay for 15 years. And like she said, I was just a woman who went to a meeting and I didn't know nothing about any of this. And all of a sudden she said, you know, that ain't right. And she's been fighting that project for 15 years. And she's by far not the person you would think would be the environmentalist fighter, but she is. And I think that's important because she is the thin green line. She is people.
People will be inspired by these activists' oral histories on the website. And thanks, Robin White and Desiree Helgers, for your work on this. Co-creators of the Thin Green Line is People, documenting Pacific Northwest fossil fuel resistance. We'll link to that site on the Old Mole KBOO webpage. And we're going to close with one of the activist oral history excerpts from the Thin Green Line. Here is Lana Jack, Salila Wyam, reminding us of what's at stake in this climate justice struggle.
Our people have been under termination for the last 60 years since the flooding of Salila Falls. And the torch was handed to me by my mothers. So I come from a long line of maternal ancestors at Salila. I was born into the activism. They're water protectors from the get, trying to save Salila Falls and keep it from being flooded. And at the same time, trying not to be exterminated as a people. But our people have been here hundreds of thousands of years, and we're still under extermination. My ancestors, the Salila Wyam, who greeted Lewis and Clark, and then for their hospitality, then in turn, our inherent sovereignty was blatantly just ignored and thrown aside as if though we didn't exist. For some of us, it's our very existence. For many of us out on the front lines in Standing Rock, we didn't stand there in our selfish need for greed, for popularity. We stood because there were many people out there in prayer. It was a prayer camp. It wasn't a protest camp. We weren't eco-terrorists who deserved to be shot at with rubber bullets and have concussion grenades and be sprayed with water in sub-zero temperatures, probably highly contaminated water. I left and most of the vet people that were in the barracks that I shared space with returned home. And three out of the four ended up in the intensive care because their kidneys and organs were shutting down. So it speaks to the chemical warfare and germ warfare that they sprayed on us regularly. I have PTS behind all of it.
That was Lana Jack Celilo Wyam, one of the climate justice activists featured in the new online resource, The Thin Green Line is People, documenting Pacific Northwest fossil fuel resistance, just discussed by Robin White and Desiree Helligers with Lori Mercier. We'll link to that site on the Old Mole KBOO webpage. That concludes our show for today. I am Patricia Kohlberg, and I have been your host. I want to thank Mole's Bill Resnick, Jan Hawken, Lori Mercier, Desiree Helligers, and Robin White for their contributions this morning, and a special thanks to our special guest, Whitney Maxey. I also want to express my gratitude for the hard work of the KBOO staff who keep the station running during these challenging times. Later today, we'll post a downloadable podcast of today's show and its individual segments to the website at kboo.fm. We will also post links to additional material that might interest you. Please join us again next Monday morning for more commentary from the point of view of the 99% and a vision of a radically democratic world. Thanks for listening, and stay safe. We're going to leave you today with our final music selection called American Skin, Bruce Springsteen's haunting refrain about the 1999 police murder in New York City of 23-year-old Amadou Diallo. After Diallo pulled his wallet out of his pocket, police fired 41 shots, 19 of which struck Diallo, who was unarmed and innocent of any crime. No police were ever indicted for the murder.
Shots, and we'll take that ride across this bloody river to the other side. 41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Well, is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret.
It ain't no secret.
No secret, my friend. You get killed just for living in your American skin.